my great honor and pleasure to be with all of you this evening. Thank you very much for being with us. Special gratitude to Robert and Kanka and Richard for their very heartfelt, transformative performance. Shishika Prabhu for kindly giving me shelter here and for opening the doors to Stanford University. Time is precious. On every level of our lives, physically, emotionally, and spiritually, our destiny is determined by how we choose to utilize our time, every moment. Chanakya Pandit, a great moralist and philosopher from ancient India, he said that if you waste even a moment, you cannot buy it back with all the wealth in creation. So there is nothing more precious than time, than each moment we have. And as human beings, we have free will at each moment to make choices. We can choose to grow or to go into deeper states of despondency and bondage. And the universal principle of all true spiritual paths is to understand that this human life is an opportunity to take a journey. A journey within. There is a metaphor that I learned years ago in the Himalayas about a particular type of deer. It's called a musk deer. And the male has an organ that excretes a particular type of oil that is so fragrant that when humans collect it, they can sell it for up to $40,000 a kilo. It's an intoxicating oil in the sense that it has a fragrance that really mesmerizes the mind. When the musk deer smells that aroma, wants to enjoy it by finding where it is. And that deer roams throughout its whole life seeking the source of that oil, sometimes crossing rivers and almost drowning, sometimes going through thorns and being cut, sometimes subjecting itself to bitter cold and burning heat, seeking that fragrance. Never realizing that it's within himself. This is the story of all of our lives. How people in this world are seeking pleasure. Ananda Mayobhyashat, the Brahma Sutra tells that we are all seeking pleasure. Something we all have in common. Whether we're billionaires or living in the streets of Mumbai, whether we're PhDs or cannot spell our names, whether we're Hindus or Muslims or Christians or Jews or Jains or Sikhs or agnostics or atheists, whether we're humans or little ants crawling on kitchen counters, Everyone is looking for pleasure. Wherever there is the presence of life, there is the search for happiness. Why is it that we all have this in common? Is it an accident? Is it by chance that we're all seeking the same thing in different ways? It's because the living force within everyone is Satchit-Ananda, is eternal, full of knowledge and full of pleasure. It is our nature. The soul, or the living force that's animating this body, like the driver of the car, is not subjected to birth or death. The pleasure of the soul is to love and to be loved. Even in this world, that's really the only thing that can satisfy the heart. It is said that things can give some pleasure to the body and mind, but only love can give pleasure to the heart. In an evolved society, people love people and use things. But in a society that has forgot its very foundational purpose, people love things and use people. Use people to get them and keep them. To a spiritually oriented person, that situation is pathetic. Years ago, just a few years ago, I went to a redwood forest. It's called King's Canyon. How many have been there? I went on a bus with some teenage youth. Somehow they let me on. And we were roaming through this forest where the largest trees on the planet are living. And we came to the General Sherman tree. That is the largest tree in the world in its volume. It had written under it some of its statistics. I'm not going to get into too many, because I forgot most of them. But one thing is, if a 6-foot man stands in front of a mouse, the mouse will have the same experience as that 6-foot man looking up at this tree, as far as proportion. 2,200 years old. And I asked some of the children, if that tree could speak to humanity, what would it tell us? That tree has been standing from before Jesus Christ was born in this world. Through the rise and the fall of the Roman Empire, through the victories of Genghis Khan, it's been there through the rise and the fall of so many empires, the British Empire. It was standing there 1,000 years before any white man or woman even touch the soils of America. Through the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, World War I, World War II, it's interesting how history is usually categorized by wars. That's the way I was taught in school. What would that tree tell us after having seen 2,200 years of history? And the boys were making all kinds of jokes about what the tree would say. But then this one girl, I think she was about 15, she started to cry as she was speaking. Her voice was faltering. And she started speaking as if the tree was speaking through her. She said, "Why are you people so foolish? Can't you see? Can't you see what I could see? Your lives are so short." This gigantic tree, in our lifetime of 80 or 90 years, it's grown about this big. 2,000 years. Since you live for such a short amount of time, why are you so cruel to each other? Just to satisfy this tiny little dying body of yours. You're committing so many atrocities. You're cheating each other. You're hurting each other. You're declaring wars. You're discriminating on the basis of your colors and your religions. You live so short. Why don't you use your life for something worthwhile? In your human birth, you have something none of us have: the opportunity to realize your eternal nature and God, to reawaken your love for God. And with your tiny little lifetimes, you're wasting it fighting amongst yourselves over such insignificant, foolish things. Why don't you wake up? As she was saying this, she was weeping. And we were weeping. When truth comes from a child, it's something very powerful. This is the opportunity that human life does give us. Atato brahmajigyasa. To ask relevant questions. Who am I? Who really am I? What is my relationship with others? What is my relationship with Mother Nature? What is my relationship with God? Why am I suffering? Is there a solution to suffering? What is the real pleasure I'm seeking? When we ask these questions, we begin to actually utilize the true potential of a human life. Then we begin our journey. I often cite the time I met Mother Teresa in 1971 in Calcutta. And she said something to me which was very universal. That the biggest problem in the world is hunger, not hunger of the stomach. Because you can give a little food and satisfy hunger of the stomach. Hunger of the heart is the problem. The heart is starving for love, and only love can satisfy the heart. And the origin of that love is our love for God. To experience God's love, we call God Krishna, the all-attractive. And to reciprocate by offering our love, that is the origin and the essence of the happiness that we're all seeking. To receive that love and to transmit that love is the greatest fulfillment of the heart. And when we connect to that fulfilling experience, the infinite love of Krishna, God. And then in a very humble way, we become instruments of that love. And whatever we do, we may be students, or engineers, or business, or politics. We may be mothers or fathers or teachers, professors, accountants, farmers, or swamis. Whatever we may do, it's not important what our role is. It's the purpose, the motivation. To be instruments of that love is the highest potential we have. I'd like to share with you a little story with your permission. I heard this story, actually I read it in a book, in a holy place. It's historical. An event that took place about 900 years ago. In South India, there's a river called the Kaveri, and it divides into two streams. And in the middle of those two streams is an island called Srirangam. And in the middle of the island is the largest temple in all of India. It's the Ranganath Temple. It's a huge temple. It covers about 150 acres. And people for over 1,000 years have gone on pilgrimage there. About 900 years ago, there was a great acharya, or spiritual teacher, whose name was Ramanuja. He established of devotion that even today there are tens and millions of followers that he has. His immediate successor was named Parashara. When Parashara was a 5-year-old child, something happened. He wasn't a successor yet. He was just a little boy, playing, studying. In those days in India, the national sport was debate. And it drew more attention and more excitement than basketball, football, baseball, soccer, all put together. If you were a champion in debate, you had the greatest honor and prestige. So the world champion in debate was coming to Sri Lanka. He was so intelligent, so charismatic, that no one could stand before him. Wherever he went, he would proclaim that he could answer any question, and no one had ever asked him a question he could not answer. So he achieved great wealth by doing this. He came into Sri Lanka, there was a marching band in front of him. Beautiful decorated palanquin where four big strong men were carrying him, because there were no Rolls Royces in those days. And there was Brahmins chanting mantras, and there were people singing his glories, whole lines of people with him, wherever he went. And all the scholars, they all ran and hid because they didn't want to be seen by him, because they knew if he saw them, he would challenge them right there, and they were sure to be humiliated and defeated. he was very proudly sitting in his palace, and his people were challenging anyone to a debate. There is no question that our guru cannot answer. Little 5-year-old Parasara ran up to the side of the palanquin and said, "I have a question for you." The scholar looked down and said, "Get out from here, you stupid child." He said, "But I have a question for you." He said, "You still have your mother's milk on your lips. Out from here." The little child said, if you're so learned, why are you categorizing me on the basis of my body? I have a question for you." He said, "Go back to the lap of your mother." The child just was looking up at him. He said, please let me ask a question." "So what is your question?" The little boy reached down and scooped up a handful of sand and said, "Please tell me how many grains of sand are in my hand." The scholar was stunned, speechless. He didn't know what to say, because he didn't know how many grains of sand were in his hand. Everybody was watching all around. There was a big crowd looking. Because this child had no malice, he was so simple and so innocent. He had no envy. He just had a pure heart. Because he asked this question, this person was defeated. Then the little boy just looked at him as he was gazing in total disorientation. The boy said, "Sir, if all your knowledge and scholarship do not give you the qualities of humility and the ability to respect others, then all your knowledge is as worthless as this handful of sand." Then the child threw the sand in the ground. The man got off his palanquin and bowed at the feet of the 5-year-old boy. Said, "You are my guru. Please teach me." He became his disciple. The boy said, "A person with good qualities is like a tree with good fruits. Such a tree, because of the weight of the fruits, naturally is always bowing down to everyone. A tree without any good fruits is standing really straight." So similarly, real attributes that are to be honored is to be able to respect and appreciate others. That is the quality of one who loves God. Years later, Parasara was a grown man, another disciple came and asked him a question. He said, my dear guru, please tell me, what are the qualities required to realize who we truly are?" Parasara was so humble. He said, "Actually, it takes a self-realized person to comprehensively answer that question. I'm not qualified to do so. But I'll tell you who is. There is a great sage named Ananda, and he lives on the top of the mountain of Tirupati. Go there and ask him this question. He has the saintliness and the wisdom to answer it. Now, in those days, there were no cars or trains or planes. There wasn't even bicycles. He walked 400 miles between Sri Rangam and Tirupati. And in that 400 miles, he had to cross wide rivers, traverse through dangerous jungles with cobras and vipers and tigers and leopards and wild elephants and wild boars and lots of mosquitoes. There were no hotels or motels on the way. If there were, I'm sure they would have Bhagavad Gita in their room. But they had to sleep under trees and sleep in caves. And then he had to climb 7 huge mountains. And finally he came to the top of the hill and met Ananta, also known as Anantacharya. He said Ananta gave him some prasad, some sanctified food, gave him a simple place to live. And the next day, the disciple asked, "O sage Ananta, please tell me, what are the qualities we should cultivate to actually understand who we are?" Ananta looked at him and said, "Let me think about it. I'll answer you another time." So he was expecting the answer later that day. The day passed. The next day passed. Weeks, months. He was there for 6 months. And during all time, he was doing his spiritual practices, and he was doing different services for this little jungle ashram where Ananta lived, and he was going to some of the classes that were being given. But Ananta never addressed his question. He just waited. After 6 months, there was a big festival being held, and thousands of people came to the hill, and there was a feast. And this disciple, he was serving the feast. He served hundreds and hundreds of people, and afterward, he sat down to eat himself. And for the first time in 6 months, Ananta actually came up to him directly, personally, and he said, There's another group of people coming. Please serve them first, then eat after." The person put down his plate and served hundreds more people. And he sat down to eat. Ananta walked up to him and said, "More people are coming. Serve them first, please." He served them. The third batch, the fourth batch, the fifth batch. Finally, it was late at night, and everyone was gone, and he was sitting alone in the field with his plate of food, and he sat down to eat it. Then Ananta came up to him again, but there was no one else there to serve. Ananta said, "If I remember right, you had a question for me." "What is your question?" Oh, he jumped up. He was really excited. He said, "Please tell me, what are the qualities that I should cultivate to understand the true self, to understand our relationship with Krishna, with Vishnu?" Ananta looked at him. He said, "One should be like salt, like a chicken, like a crane, and like you. That's all I have to say about your question." He walked away. The man was really confused. He waited 6 months for that. It didn't make any sense. He offered his pranams, he bowed down to Ananta, he packed his little bag, and he walked down the seven hills and across the dangerous forests and the wide rivers. 400 miles later, he returned to his home in Sri Lanka. And when he came, he was walking through the streets, and there was Parasara, his guru. He was really tired. He walked a long way. And Parasara said, "Oh, you came back only 6 months later." He said, "Did you get your answer?" He said, "Yes." Parasara said, "Well, what did he say?" He said that a true devotee is like salt, like a chicken, like a crane, like me. Parasara started clapping. He said, "What a wonderful answer. So precise and comprehensive. Perfect answer." The disciple, he looked at his guru and said, "I'm confused. I don't understand. What does salt and chickens have to do with anything?" Parasara said, "Let me explain to you the fathomless wisdom of Anantacharya. What are the qualities of salt? If you put the right amount of salt in a preparation, it gives it great flavor. If you put too little, it doesn't have proper flavor. If you put too much, it spoils it. Salt must be balanced." And similarly, in the Bhagavad Gita, it teaches those who are on the path of true dharma are those who do not eat too little or too much, who do not sleep too little or too much, who are balanced in their occupation, their recreation, their spiritual practices. Their relationships and times with their family. Everything should be balanced very carefully. And then we actually bring out the real flavor of life. We should not go to extremes, which is so much the tendency to just become obsessed with extremes. Balance is a great secret for growth. Another quality of salt is it gives flavor, but it doesn't expect recognition. It's like if you eat a nice vegetable preparation, you may say, "This is very, very tasteful vegetables and very excellent spices." But for those of you who are cooks, how many of you have ever been given a compliment? "The salt in this preparation is fantastic." Salt gives so much flavor to everything else, all the spices, the vegetables, the grains, but nobody ever recognizes the salt. In the same way, a true devotee is very eager to help others in every way, to serve God in every way, to accomplish things in beautiful ways for others' benefit, but does not expect or demand credit for oneself. One's happy just with the opportunity, with the privilege to serve. Another quality of salt. Do you ever think of salt this way? Is salt merges itself into the preparation. It actually loses its identity in a certain sense to merge into the food. And in a similar way, a true devotee becomes absorbed. It's not that we lose our identity, but we lose our ego. The ego that separates us from other people, that separates us from God, that separates us from nature. And when we engage in our spiritual practices or our seva or our occupation for that higher purpose, we become absorbed. We become one in our spirit of love and harmony for the pleasure of the Lord. The disciple asked Parasara, well, what about chickens? How are self-realized souls like chickens? Now, usually in this world, chickens are not praised so much. If you do something wonderful, does anybody say, oh, you are a chicken? They say you're strong like a lion, or you're fearless like a tiger, or you dance beautiful like a peacock, or you sing like a nightingale. But if somebody calls you a chicken, it's usually an insult. How are great personalities like chickens? Parasara said, oh, chicken. Let me tell you about the chicken. This is the best part. He said, if there is a pile of trash, usually trash is all kinds of decomposed stuff, things that are useless, and nobody wants it, the chicken will go to that trash and find, even if there's one or two nutritious seeds. Similarly, one who is aspiring to know the self must become saragrahi. In Sanskrit, saragrahi means one who seeks the essence. One who sees the good qualities in others and doesn't really concern themselves with all the bad qualities. One who actually learns how to appreciate. One who sees beyond all the coverings of egoism and mental speculations and activities that people may perform, within it all is the Atman. There's a soul, and that soul is a part of God. And to be aware of that, to seek the essence. When my guru Srila Prabhupada came to the West, he came from Vrindavan, the holiest of all holy places in India for those on the path of bhakti. And he lived in the heart of Vrindavan, Seva Kunj, where the Ras Lila, the epitome, the summum bonum of all spiritual realizations, is revealed. And he came to the West on a cargo ship, 38 days. He had $8, but he couldn't change the rupees. And he lived not far from here in Haight-Ashbury. First he was in the Lower East Side of New York, and then a couple months later he came and lived in Haight-Ashbury. And at that time, in 1968, it was really, for him, unbelievable. It was the height of the hippie movement, the counterculture. Somebody asked Prabhupada at that time, can you show me magic? And they were wanting Prabhupada to make some ashes or produce some gold or read minds or do some magic like that, because they thought that's what yogis are supposed to do. And Prabhupada said, my magic is that I have made hippies into happies. Transform these people. How did he do that? Even though some of these people were so depressed, some were addicted to drugs and alcohol, some, you know, really had no direction in life, he saw whatever little spark of good was in them. And he focused on that spark and fanned that spark and knew that if he just nourished that spark, it would become a fire and all the layers and layers and layers of bad qualities would naturally be dissolved. Like here in the Bay Area, you have fog, but the sun evaporates the fog. So that sun, Prabhupada saw, was in everyone. And that was actually the quality that gave all these people the chance to transform is someone saw their potential and focused on it and appreciated it rather than just beating them down because of their faults. This is the quality that the chicken teaches us, to see that nourishing seed, even if it's in a pile of rubbish. And similarly, when it comes to religion, Savai Punksam Paro Dharamo Yatopakti Rokshaji Aitakya Pratiyata Yagatma Suprasidati. Srimad Bhagavatam tells that the supreme Dharma, Dharma means occupation, Dharma means spiritual path, or religion. The supreme Dharma, the essence of Dharma, is that which awakens loving devotion and service from within the heart. That is the nature of the soul. Such loving service must be unmotivated by egoism or selfishness and uninterrupted by any circumstance to actually satisfy the self. But so often in this world, and we see it all the time, in the name of religion, people focus so much on the external forms and rituals without understanding that the purpose of them is to bring us to the essence. And therefore, in the name of a path that is meant to breed or cultivate love, people hate. Not only do they hate, but they learn to hate to absolute dimensions. Spirituality is the greatest power on earth because it connects us to the highest source. And it also can awaken people's faith. When there are proper spiritual guides, it creates unity, harmony, love, compassion, and humility. When those same conceptions are taught without understanding the essence, they can create arrogance, judgmentalism, hate, terrorism. We can learn from the chicken in our own spiritual path how to seek the essence and how to see. And when we understand the essence, then all the rituals and all of the various practices become extremely beautiful and helpful. Another quality of a chicken, do you ever think of chickens this way? Is it seeks the essence in situations. Every situation is an opportunity to grow or an opportunity to dwindle. We can complain about our situation. We could blame others for our situation. We could blame God for our situation. We could be depressed over our situation. We could be angry and envious about our situation. Or we could see it as an opportunity to humble ourselves, an opportunity to persevere with faith in a higher power. Every situation, whatever it may be, and there are so many incredible stories, contemporary world and history, about people who were in situations that could justify suicide, depression, or total failure. And they soared to heights beyond human comprehension of prosperity internally and externally because they saw a positive opportunity in that situation. That is the lesson of a chicken. Not to just complain and blame, but to see what I could do. When people would complain to my Gurudev about certain situations, he wouldn't just listen and say, "Oh, I'm sorry." He would say, "Then do something about it. Do something in this situation. Transform the situation. See the opportunity." My best friend, Bhakti Tirthaswami, he was African American. He was a Princeton graduate, civil rights leader in the 1960s. He came to my guru when he first started coming to the temple and said, "Prabhupada, even though you're teaching that we're not this body, we're the eternal soul, and you're teaching the equality of all life on this spiritual platform, devotees in your temple are prejudiced against me because I'm black. There's racism among your devotees. Because you see, Srila Prabhupada on another occasion, he said, when you come to a real spiritual path, it's not that you're clean, but at least you're coming into the shower. And it's the process of getting clean. He said, when you go to a hospital, it's not that everybody's healthy, but they're coming to get healthy. So you can't expect everybody to be saintly. But some people are saintly. And others are trying to help each other to become like that. So in Bhakti Tirthaswami, his name was John at the time, he said this, that there are people, there are devotees who are racist, who are prejudiced in this temple. And Prabhupada looked at him and said, "If you are disturbed by that, then what makes you different than them?" Think about that. That's very deep. He thought about it, and it transformed and enlightened his life forever. That their problem is that they're identifying with your body as being black, and you're disturbed by it because you're identifying with your body as being African American. If you identify your own self as a soul and see them, then you can transcend it. You can deal with it with compassion. And he did that. And he became one of the greatest saints in this world. Nelson Mandela, Muhammad Ali, Alice Coltrane, they came to him for instruction because he had such a transcendental divine state of consciousness. Lesson of the chicken. And a crane. A crane is a bird. It's not the cranes that build skyscrapers. They have long legs and big pointed beaks. And Parasara told the disciple, the nature of a crane is it stands on one leg in a stream of water. and just looks down. And as he's looking down in the water, so many little fish come swimming by. He just patiently lets them pass. Hundreds and hundreds of little fish are swimming by. He just watches, lets them pass. When a big fish comes, he feasts. I think he doesn't sound like that. Sorry. But I think the idea is he feasts on the big fish. Now, this analogy is not to inspire you to eat fish. It's a lesson that he is looking for. He's seen the big picture, and he's not disturbed by all the little things that pass by. He's looking for the big thing. And this is very important, to be happy in this world, because there are so many distractions, so many little things that come into our life that we get disturbed by, upset by, we react to, and then we make things so much worse. For a lot, he said, if we don't have proper knowledge, if we're not focused on the higher goals of life, then the solutions to our problems create bigger problems than the original problems. Yes. Look at the world today. Ecology, the environment, the rise of cancer. You know, people with earnest and good hearts sometimes, they try to make, you know, solutions to problems. But because they didn't see the big picture, their problems created huge, their solutions created huge problems. Whether it's in marriage, friendships, relationships, there are so many little things that we can fight about. But actual dharma is when we focus on the higher principles of why we are together, what we are trying to achieve, what is our purpose. Vishayagani Vartante Niraharasya Dehina Rasa Bharajam Rasokyasya Param Dristvani Vartate. The Bhagavad Gita explains that the mind and the senses can easily be so distracted and disturbed by so many stupid little things. Do any of you ever have that experience? But if we focus on the higher, more meaningful things, then the little things don't matter. Like the crane, we just watch all the little fish go by, about all these distractions and all these little problems and all these little issues and all these little quarrels that we gossip. The philosophy of the crane is we should focus our minds not to be distracted by the gossip and propaganda that permeates this world, but focus on the truth. And when we focus on the truth, we let all these little things go. When a husband and a wife focus on the higher principle of what we have taken vows of marriage, we are entrusted with these children, it doesn't matter what differences we have. We have this higher purpose. And they rise above all those things. When friends, it's very rare in this day and age for people to remain friends for very long because of so many distractions. And what to speak of our own integrity? Let the little fish flow by, just watch them. And we deal with it, but we don't focus on that. We focus on the real purpose of why we're here. In the path of bhakti, we chant God's holy names. Because by chanting these names, it's a meditation on the all-beautiful, all-loving, supreme truth of Krishna, we call. And by focusing on Krishna and loving service to Krishna, then all these other issues of this world, we just deal with them according from that platform of seva and compassion. And we're not distracted or disturbed. The disciple said, well, what about me? How is a disciple like me? And Parasara said, you walked 400 miles because you were so eager to get the answer. And then you patiently did seva and did your spiritual practices for 6 months and you didn't get anything, but you had faith that it would come. And then you served everyone in that feast, in that festival, before yourself. Those are the qualities of a person who will understand the self. That they persevere with patience. And they put the welfare of others above their own selfish interests. Ananda taught you. Do you know why he made you wait 6 months? Because the heart is like a field. And love of God, self-realization, is like a seed. If the heart is fertile, then the seed will grow and prosper. Humility and gratitude, qualities in all of our spiritual practices, will take a very, very long time. But if we have this humility, gratitude, and patience, and enthusiasm, then whatever spiritual practices, whatever seva or service, the seed of love will grow and prosper. And do you know why he didn't explain these things to you? Why he gave you such a cryptic answer? Because he's so kind to me. He knew that you would be totally bewildered and confused by his answer. And that you would come to me and I would get the honor and pleasure and I would get all the benefits of being enlightened by explaining it to you. How wonderful. If we're seeking the truth with proper spiritual direction, we can find great enlightenment even by witnessing the most common things all around us every day, like salt and chickens and cranes. This is how you take the journey within. By associating with people who actually learn, teach us how to see God's grace and message in even the everyday things of this world. My dear God brothers, Bhanubhata Prabhu, Satyadev Prabhu, and Vaisheshika Prabhu, Kanka Devi, they've been serving for over 40 years, practicing this wonderful path of devotion. They have such humility and such gratitude, and they've been given such treasures, and they want to share those treasures. That's why they're so enthusiastic to give out Srila Prabhupada's books, which are that wisdom, that knowledge, those realizations, that grace that help us actually see the world around us such a way that we can continuously come closer to God. Stanford University is one of the most important places for education in the world. Just about a month ago, I was invited to speak at the London Business School. And when I was there, they told me that in the whole world, the three most recognized business schools are Harvard, Stanford, and London Business School. But somebody else said, no, Stanford, Harvard, and London Business School. I don't know. I told them that I haven't signed a check or had a bank account since 1969. But I'm grateful to be here with all of you and to share these thoughts with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Hisolas Radhanaswamy, for enlightening us on this topic of journey within. At this point, if I would like to ask any question, make any comment, please raise your hand. Pass the mic to them.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare Krishna. What is your name?
Annetta. Annetta. Thank you. I've met you many times. My privilege. So I have a question. You talked about cultivating humility and what was it? Seeing opportunities, I think. Gratitude. So I was wondering if I want to help others fertilize the ground for the spiritual seed, would it help if I can help them to develop gratitude, to see the opportunities and the obstacles, to develop a positive attitude towards what they have seen as hardships in their lives?
Please do that. Obstacles and hardships could be interpreted as a curse or a blessing. If we interpret it as a curse, it will be a curse. If we interpret it as a blessing, it will be a blessing. Because in every situation we can learn, we can gain in wisdom, we can humble ourselves before God. But in order to transform those obstacles into beautiful blessings, we can achieve something that we could have never achieved without those obstacles. It requires faith. And that faith becomes real when we're in the company of people with faith. It can really help us. Recently, I was with a lady. A long story. I've told it before here, I think. But when she was 9 years old, she was forced to get married. She was from a poverty-stricken little village in India. When she was 19, she had three sons and was pregnant with a daughter. And a criminal influenced her husband to kill her. He kicked her in the womb until she was totally unconscious, and he thought she was dead. He dragged her into a cow shed. Because it was crowded with cows and bulls. And the idea was that they would think the people would think that the cows and bulls trampled on her, and that's how she died. But one cow, mother cow, stood over her body and wouldn't let anything or anyone come near her. It was fighting off everything else. If any bull or cow came near, somebody would take her horns and get them away. And she stood right over this woman, who was unconscious for hours. And when she woke up, she was in total pain, and she saw what was happening. This cow was defending her, protecting her. She gave birth under the cow. She cut her umbilical cord with a stone. For hours, she was helplessly laying there. She couldn't even stand up. And the cow was right over her, giving protection. When she finally did stand up, she embraced the cow and promised the cow, "Because you helped me when I was helpless, I will dedicate my life to helping the helpless." It's a long story, but essentially her life became so difficult. She went to her biological home, and they rejected her because it was the tradition of her family, crazy tradition, that once a woman is married, she can never come back to her father or mother's home. So she lived like that. She's 19, she's an infant. She was afraid of getting raped and abused, so she slept crematorium, just an open sky area on a riverbank where they would burn dead bodies. And she slept and lived in the crematorium, and she acted crazy, so everyone thought she was a ghost. And nobody bothered her. She would collect wheat, put some river water, and make rotis out of the burning corpses. After some time, it was just so hopeless, she decided to commit suicide. She went to the railway tracks. Laid in the railway tracks with her little baby, waiting for the train to run them over. While she was there, she heard somebody crying for help. She got off the track and found an old man who was starving for water. She ran and got some water for him. She started singing songs and begging and got some food for him. And he was so grateful. She was thinking, "I have a purpose in this world. I could do something. I can help others. Look, I can actually do something." And she was laying in a field in the hot summer under a tree. She was thinking, "Well, what am I going to do? I'm completely beaten down." And then she saw above her was a branch that was brutally axed by a woodsman. It was just hanging by a shred. And she noticed it was giving her and her child shade from the sun. "Yes, as beaten down as I am, I can do something." And she started helping children. And soon she became the mother of the orphans. People built an orphanage for her. She had 1,500 children. And over 1,000 grandchildren. And she won over 270 national and international awards. And she was invited to over 30 countries to speak. But she said that the most satisfying thing she ever did in her life was after she had established these orphanages and everything, one day this really old homeless man in rags, he was about 80 years old, he came to the orphanage and begged for help. And she recognized that was her husband. That was the man who kicked her and beat her and tried to kill her. And you know what she said to him? She said, "When you kicked me out of the house, I was in rags and you were wearing nice clothes. Now I'm wearing nice clothes and you're in rags. When you kicked me out, I was helpless and starving and you were eating. Now I'm eating and you're helpless and starving." He begged for forgiveness. She forgave him. And she said, "You could live in the orphanage, but you're not my husband. You're my son. I'm only a mother these days." And she gave him shelter. And he actually completely transformed. She told the other children that, "Give him your love. He needs it the most." And then she told, when visitors would come, she would sometimes introduce him. "This is my eldest son." She was like in her 50s. When she married this man, she was 9 and he was 35. That was how they got married. So now she's like in her 50s and he's in his 80s. She'd say, "This is my eldest son. And a very naughty son." But she said, "My life was full of thorns." The path of my life was full of thorns. She said, "But I made friends with all those thorns. They all make me a better person because I took shelter of Krishna." She became a devotee of Krishna through this whole thing. I heard this story from some people who went to one of her lectures. And then I came here to America and I told it to many people because I was inspired by it. And you know what happened? I was in Vrindavan with about 5,000 people on a pilgrimage. And the day I was supposed to leave, I got a call. She was on the phone. I never met her. She wanted to meet. Someone gave her the journey home in the Marathi language, and she read it. And she said to me, "I read your book, and you are like my Krishna." So I wanted to reciprocate. I said, "Well, I heard your story, and your story inspires me. You're like my Radha." It was kind of like an on-the-spot thing. Because it was a speaker phone, somebody's translating. And she said, "No, I am Yashoda." "I am your mother, nothing else." So I thought that was nice. So anyways, a few months later in Pune, I was giving a lecture, and there was about 7,000 or 8,000 people at this event that I was supposed to speak on, and she was supposed to speak there also. It was arranged that we would speak together, and before that event, we met in someone's house, and we spoke for about an hour. And at the end of the talk, we were just sharing our realizations and talking about Krishna and bhakti and so many things in life. It was just beautiful. And there was this one young lady sitting next to her. She wasn't saying much, but she just looked so full of life and so full of enthusiasm and thought. She was constantly smiling. And as we were about to part to go to that stage to speak, she said, "Oh, by the way, I want you to introduce me. This is my daughter. She's the one who was born under the cow." And now she's a medical doctor, and she's taken charge of one of our orphanages. There are hundreds of millions of stories similar to this, of how people and sheep, whatever difficulties and tragedies and traumas that she went through in life, she transformed them into ways in which she could help people that she could have never done before without that. That's how she transformed curses into blessings. That's extreme. But in our own little ways in life, if we look for the opportunity to grow, to humble ourselves before God, to transform these injustices even into ways that we can be compassionate to others, and it's a blessing. Because like at the beginning of my talk, like that General Sherman Tree was saying, we don't have very long. Compared to a redwood tree, our lifespan is very, very tiny. But we have the opportunity, but we shouldn't let anything distract us from the opportunity that we all have as human beings to love God, to be an instrument of that love. Everyone has that potential. Does that answer your question?
Thank you so much, Maharaj. I really appreciate it. Hare Krishna.
Thank you, Hare Krishna. It's time next month. It's such a good time. Because I like redwood trees so much, sometimes I go over time. One more question? This chanting of Hare Krishna, 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 and to really keep focused on that higher reality. These divine sound vibrations in this mantra, which are names of God, awaken that capacity of unconditional love within our heart. Thank you very much.